From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. More than a week ago, Reverend Jeremiah Wright was supposed to step down as senior pastor of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. That's the church from which Senator Barack Obama resigned his membership. Reverend Otis Moss III was already handpicked to take over at the pulpit, but in a last-minute move, Reverend Wright decided the 37-year-old minister wasn't ready. How hard is it for black leaders to pass the torch? And as America grapples with the possibility of electing its first black president, are traditional civil rights leaders ready for a new generation to take the helm? For more, we have Reverend Al Sharpton, president of the National Action Network. Reverend Sharpton, great to have you on.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
You know, I remember we talked before. We've talked several different times. And you said something about your generation, which is that you're not of the hip-hop generation, but you're also younger than Reverend Jesse Jackson and some of the other people who were associates of Reverend King. So how do you see yourself situated in this whole transition of leadership or passing of the torch from generation to generation?
Well, I think that there's the generation ahead of the group I'm with and the generation behind. And I think that every era, we're always in transition. I think in the civil rights of the 60s and the 50s, they were in transition with the generation of Reverend Jackson and Stokely Carmichael, who operated in their time in transition with people now that are in their 40s and 50s, which is the generation I'm in. For example, Deval Patrick and I are around the same age, and David Patterson, who's governor of New York, and I are around the same age. Barack Obama is only 6 years younger. So I think that we're in a generation that are older than the hip-hop generation. I think that sometimes, right, we see the media too simplistic in their analysis. Every generation has different people that do different things. So, for example, in Dr. King's time, Ed Brooke was the senator from Massachusetts. He was elected a year before Dr. King died, getting elected in a state that was mostly a white state. In Jesse Jackson's height, Doug Wilder was elected at a time in Virginia, in a southern former Confederate state. At the time, Reverend Jackson and others were doing activism. In the time I'm operating now, I see a Deval Patrick elected governor. I see Barack as a Democratic nominee. All of this happening at the same time. What I think is the misconception is that blacks only do one thing per generation. There's always been blacks that serve different functions at the same time in the same generation.
What about the passing of the torch? In some cases, you know, for example, we spoke with Julian Bond a while back, and he asked him, you know, should leadership be passed as a torch or should people have to snatch it? And he said, snatch it. He was no bones about it. How do you feel about that?
I think you have to define which torch you're trying to aspire to. And second, I think that people have to earn trust. At the end of the day, leadership is based on following, and you can't impose that. I think that in one level, I don't know if I would say snatch it, you've got to earn it. I grew up in SCLC Operation Breadbasket under Reverend Jackson and Bill Jones, but they couldn't make me what I became. I had to earn that and earn my own public outing. And I think that what, to be frankly, a lot of the major mainstream media tries to do is appoint new leadership, which to me is almost humorous. Like, people are going to trust them and follow them or deal with them because they've been appointed. That's crazy. The reason why many of the issues that those of us in the civil rights community respond is because people call on us. Well, why do they call us? Because they trust us and they have seen our track record. Will younger people be able to do that? Absolutely. As long as they don't delude themselves that they can be appointed by even those ahead of them. They have to earn that. They have to get in the trenches and do the work. The biggest confusion that the media gives, Farai, is they try to have this monolith of black leadership, which they do not do in any other community. For example, people don't realize we had Martin Luther King in the South, Malcolm X in the North, Thurgood Marshall in the courts, Adam Clayton Powell in Congress, Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi, Gloria Richardson in North Carolina, all at the same time, Whitney Young in the corporate boardroom, all at the same time. How do we get to the 21st century and act like came but one black talk at a time? That's absurd. It has never been our case, and it should not be depicted as that now.
You mention the media a lot of times, and, you know, although I'm in the media, I'm not uncritical, but there are specific cases where people have shown that they don't want to give leadership or pass it on. Reverend Jeremiah Wright has been in the news many times, but most recently he was supposed to step down as senior pastor of Trinity United, which is the church that Barack Obama used to go to. There was a 37-year-old minister, Otis Moss, who was ready to step up to the plate. But then at the last minute, Reverend Wright said, oh, well, yeah, I'm just going to stay in the seat, stay in the pulpit, stay the pastor. What do you think happens at a time like that when someone is supposed to pass the torch and they don't?
Well, I don't know the particulars of that, so I couldn't comment on that. But I think that in a general, broader question of what you're asking, there has been resistance of people that when it was time to move on and agreed to move on, didn't. And I think that constituency has to deal with that. And I think sometimes those things are tense. Sometimes they can even get ugly. I think that at the end of the day, if you are really about what you say you're about, you want to see the pursuit of those goals even beyond your time of your day in the sun. I'm not at all suggesting that's what happened here because I don't know, but I think I have seen that happen in other cases, and I think that that's the real testimony of the sincerity of the person. I think the best example I could give is Nelson Mandela. Who's paid more of a price? Who sacrificed more? He won. And then at a point he says, now it's time for me to go on. He, if anyone, earned the right to say, I'm going to sit here and be the president of South Africa till I die. He said, no, I've served my time. The fact that I spent 27 years in jail notwithstanding, I'm going to move on. And I think that that is why everyone respected him as a great man, because he did not put his own vanity above the cause.
Reverend Sharpton, great to talk to you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Reverend Al Sharpton is a civil rights activist and host of the syndicated radio talk show Keeping It Real. He's also the president of the National Action Network. Now, we just heard from Reverend Sharpton talking about how diverse Black leadership has been in style and approach, but how well do different generations work together and who's coming up in the ranks? Here to talk about passing the torch is James Rucker. He's executive director and co-founder of the San Francisco-based group Color of Change. Their projects have included web-based organizing for the protest around the Gina Six case. Also with us, Charles Steele Jr. He's national president and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It's a civil rights organization co-founded by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So, Charles, we just heard Reverend Sharpton talking about the diversity of Black leadership. What do you think is the hallmark of Black leadership today, or some of the diversity?
Well, first of all, prior to my coming to SCLC as president and CEO, currently I've been here 4 years. And prior to coming here, I envisioned an institution in terms of the international and global concerns of civil rights and human rights in terms of SCLC. 5 hours prior to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. being assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, he looked over to his first lieutenant, one of his first lieutenants, Dr. Bernard Lafayette, and said, Lafayette, now is the time to institutionalize and internationalize SCLC. Why am I reflecting and referring back to that particular moment? Due to the fact that under my administration, president and CEO of SCLC, we have institutionalized the movement here at our international headquarters, as well as internationalized it. Due to the fact that there are many persons in terms of the hip-hop generation who have come to me, and particularly being here in Atlanta, Georgia, who said, why you all didn't convey or transform the information to us? We want to be a part of the civil rights movement, but we feel that we've been left behind. We are empty on the inside.
Well, let me ask you specifically, how do you reach out to people from the hip-hop generation in that case?
Well, first of all, you make them feel inclusive. You include them. And they told me themselves that they felt that they've been excluded in terms of the civil rights movement, that they've been beat upon, that they've been looked down upon, and that they want to be a part of this, but they don't even know the history of the movement. And they're saying that because you are institutionalizing SCLC, now we can be trained and we can lead from our perspective in terms of our culture, because it is a culture. And secondly, we need to recognize the hip-hop culture and make it a part of the civil rights movement. Let me say this and I'll pause. We're starting a hip-hop institute at Knoxville College. in Knoxville, Tennessee. Well, we're actually going to have a hip-hop institute with George Curry, who's working along with me, who's chairman of the board of Knoxville College, and we're going to have a curriculum that people can actually go and study not only civil rights in terms of what we are and where we were 50 or 60 years ago, but also to embark upon the future.
Charles,
it would be the hip-hop culture and the civil rights movement.
Okay, well, I interrupt only because we have a little bit of time now, but we're going to come back later. I want to give you a chance to jump in before we do, James.
Sure.
Quickly, how do you reach out to the hip-hop generation, which seems to have responded to your kind of electronic organizing?
Yeah, well, one is, you know, basically doing work on issues that matter. And, you know, if you look at the case of the Gina Six, I mean, I think what was very, you know, important to take note of is that, you know, you could be 15 years old, you could be, you know, 85 years old and understand that nooses communicate a very, very serious and dangerous message to black folks. And the organizing method, I mean, there was a degree of a very high degree of activity online, Facebook groups, MySpace groups, that tied back to the actions both online in terms of lobbying the governor, you know, to actually going to Gina. So I think part of it is, you know, being relevant in terms of the issues that you're working on to young people. And then also I think it's being plugged into folks where they are. And if folks are hanging out on MySpace or Facebook, creating opportunities for them to engage that exist there, I think is a big part of it.
All right. Well, Charles and James, stick around for a few more minutes. We're going to take a quick break. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Let's jump back into our conversation about passing the torch of leadership in African-American communities. We are speaking with Charles Steele, Jr., president and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, plus James Rucker, executive director of the organization Color of Change. So welcome back, gentlemen. James, you were just talking about issue-based organizing. You got a name for yourself among a wider audience with the Gina Six case. What are you working on right now?
Yeah, well, there are several issues. In fact, the Gina Six cases aren't actually resolved, so there's still work we're doing there. Part of what we're trying to do is highlight, you know, from the beginning, really, the case of the Gina Six is one instance of the kind of unequal justice that happens in places all around the country, actually. Looking at, for instance, crack versus powder cocaine sentencing, we've got, you know, many, many black men locked up, in particular not just black men, but locked up for very long periods of time for possessions of very small amounts of crack cocaine. For powder cocaine, the sentences are much less, and you have, you know, it's a kind of wider audience that's being you know, dealt with. So there's basically unequal justice work. There's still a lot of unfinished Katrina work. And fundamentally, what I think is important just in terms of as we look at kind of old versus new, is having a model focused on empowerment and focused on individuals, wherever they are, whatever generation they are, from being talked to in a way that resonates with them and having an opportunity to make change happen. And part of the beauty of the web is that it enables us to do that in very large numbers across geography. There are times when it does come down to the ground, like it did in Gina, but there's so much work that happens, you know, in the halls of Congress, that doesn't create, where we don't have those kind of images and things that will move the public. It takes grassroots organizing, you know, kind of on a constant level to make change happen.
Charles, we recently saw a new president-elect of the NAACP, the youngest ever in history, man in his mid-30s. How do you bring people in to the SCLC, not necessarily as the president, but people in key leadership positions? Who do you have on tap who, say, is in their 30s or even 20s?
Well, we have quite a few young people that's working with us, and particularly the hip-hop generation. I'm making a special effort to deal with that particular aspect of culture that we must mesh and bring together. In terms of the hip-hop culture, I'm working with the Hip-Hop Caucus, and the hip-hop culture generally, but the Hip-Hop Caucus with Reverend Yearwood, we're working together on voter registration and education in terms of 645,000 database hip-hop persons that's actually committed to work in the civil rights movement as well as holistically throughout America in terms of the issue-based concerns that we would bring to the forefront. But the point being is that SCLC is known as the organization around the world with the moral authority. What do you mean by that? I mean that we change the whole world and we never fired a shot. People throughout the world are asking us to teach them. So we started to implement through curriculums, and through high school, as well as four-year institutions, master's degree program, PhD programs, where people can actually study and get degreed in the Kenyan theory. This is a theory that's basically teaching the nonviolent approach to education, as well as resolving issues of concern that conflict on a cultural basis, as well as racially, and also economically, where people can resolve their issues nonviolently through the methods and principles and mindset of Dr. King and others in the civil rights movement, rather than using violence as an alternative.
James, how well do you and your organization play in the sandbox with others? I know that's, you know, a question that you're going to say, oh, great, great, great. But you know, who do you network with in terms of other organizations?
Yeah, well, we've made a habit of trying to reach out to really anyone and everyone who can play a role. In fact, you know, what we really like to do is find folks who are doing work and it's successful. It's about amplifying their message and getting more folks engaged in the work. And, you know, of course, there are challenges. I think one of the things that we sometimes fall prey to, and I think this is true with any kind of marginalized group, is, you know, folks will kind of try to claim territory and that kind of thing. And I really think part of, you know, what's going to make this work, you know, reach more people and have a bigger impact is getting beyond that and recognizing, actually, as Reverend Sharpton said, I mean, there are many folks who are needed. There are many organizations that are needed. And I do think that we need to learn, you know, to kind of really take that to heart. One of the things I think we also have to be able to do is challenge each other, right? Hold each other accountable. And that's something that I think we still need some practice with.
What about, you've mentioned specific issues that you're working on, but what about the sort of umbrella of how well African Americans do overall in terms of racial justice, economic justice, et cetera. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the framing around the civil rights movement was about the color line, which was a legal, hard and fast rule.
Right.
And we have a lot of issues, but there's not necessarily any one line in the sand.
Right.
James first and then Charles. How do you deal with the fact that there's not just one issue now? There was never just one, but that there's not one color line.
Right. No, I think that's a critical point, because I think it also it permeates the whole landscape of organizing and change making. We don't have, again, this kind of simple imagery, these situations where it's change this law, create a new law that will, you know, deliver some big change. So yes, I think it's actually engaging people in the practice of making change. You know, we all have our families, our lives, but to feel like there is a group of individuals, there's a collective through which I can make change happen, I think that is a big part of the key, actually, to making it actually sustainable.
Charles, what about the color line? It no longer exists, but discrimination does.
Well,
how do you deal with that?
First of all, the color line still exists. You know, let's not be misled of thinking that we have reached a certain plateau of utopia where you don't have the racial divide or the racial issues of concern that you had in the 50s or the 60s. You still have those concerns. The big three in terms of the evil concerns in society when Dr. King was around was basically racism, poverty, and violence. And I challenge anyone today to deal with those three issues or concerns: racism, poverty, and violence. We must realize that we are not there. We'll never get there. And you have to fight on a daily basis. And the fact that we have made some accomplishments, sure, that's fine. But you still have the racial divide of the day that you had in the 50s and the 60s. It just come in a different form.
Charles,
yes.
How do you get people involved who may not agree with you on that? I mean,
well, they didn't agree with Dr. King. They didn't agree back 50 years ago when we told them about the same ills in society, racism, poverty, and violence. People would never agree in terms of the real concerns of issue because of their lackadaisia in terms of wanting to take on the giants. But I tell people the giants will always come, and they keep on coming. So what did we have just a year ago? The reversal of Brown versus Board of Education, May 17, 1954. We don't have that. That was the catalyst of the civil rights movement. We don't have that. and that decide and vote was by a black man. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm.
We don't have Brown versus Board of Education anymore. That was the first act in terms of the Civil Rights Movement. That motivated Miss Mamie Till Mobley, Mamie Till, Emmett Till Mama, to open that casket of August 1955 because of Brown versus Board of Education. What motivated Rosa Parks? Mamie Till, when she opened that casket in Chicago on that hot 100-degree day when she let the whole world see the racist mindset of the Jim Crowism out of Mississippi. That motivated Rosa Parks. These some of the first, 1955.
All right, James, very briefly, when you think about that long legacy and litany of things that have happened in the past, there's not always going to be a Gina Six that should just be the issue around the torch. Give me a word or two about what do you think the key issue is that you're dealing with?
Well, the issue that we really, I mean, fundamentally, we are trying to get people engaged in the practice of making change. And so there are situations like the Gina Six where our hope is that, you know, one on the one hand, we deliver justice or we help justice be achieved for these young men. But there are obscure, you know, there are things, for instance, like education, and that's one of the places where we want to focus very big because we don't have it's not like there's Jim Crow. It's not like there's official or unofficial segregation in kind of a simple way.
James.
But you have schools that have been failing for decades, these same kids.
All right. Well, James Charles, thanks so much for the spirited discussion.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Charles Steele Jr. is the national president and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and James Rucker is the executive director and co-founder of Color of Change. Wanting the torch is one thing, but what if you had the torch thrust upon you? When Martin Luther King III was born in 1957, his father was in his 20s. The name they share is now synonymous with the civil rights movement. Today, Martin Luther King III heads an organization called Realizing the Dream. Martin, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit about Realizing the Dream. What is it that you're set out to do?
Well, Realizing the Dream, I started after my mom passed, and we focus on conflict resolution, nonviolence training, targeted youth leadership development, and economic development as the three issues. Over the last 20 months or so, I've traveled to communities across America, from Appalachian communities to rural communities to Native American communities to urban communities, looking at poverty. We've been to about 37 communities. Our goal is to get America to focus on poverty. Even in this very difficult economic scenario for Americans, we have enough, I believe, to address poverty in America. I think that in a 15-year period, we could certainly reduce poverty by half. But we just have not had the will to do that. We have the ability, but the will has not been identified thus far.
Your father, of course, organized a Poor People's March, and now the economy is in such straits that a message like yours would seem to have a broad target. Do you find that people are listening when you talk, or are people so preoccupied with their day-to-day struggles that they're not really thinking about movement building?
Well, I find today that there's more of an interest than I've seen in a number of years. Part of it certainly is the fact that this has been an election year. But even prior to that, for the last year and a half to 2 years now, there's been an interest, a buzz from around the country, and particularly with young people. That's, for me, the most important thing. And we can and must do a better job. We certainly, as Americans, can do more.
On the website for your organization, Realizing the Dream, you are listed as an international human rights activist and political leader. What if you wanted to be a painter or someone who was an architect? Or what if you wanted to do something that was not in any way directly aligned with what your parents had done? Would you feel that you had the freedom to take a very different path?
Well, I would like to think that my mom, we were raised by, of course, my dad was killed when I was 10 years old, so primarily my mom was the one that raised us, and she always taught us to be our best selves, that we did not have to follow in the footsteps of our parents. But the fact of the matter is, their message was so prevalent in our lives and so much a part of the fabric of who we are that I don't feel I really had a choice per se. What I do believe fervently is that my mom would not have pushed me to do to go into the work that I'm involved in. But again, I don't see how one could be exposed to what I was exposed to and not have a desire to be a, to try to be a change agent. But in the back of my mind, sure, if I wanted to be a painter or something different, maybe I could have done that.
Have you ever felt criticized or judged because you weren't your father and someone expected you to be?
Oh, absolutely. I think I'm thankful that also my mom taught us just be your best self. You don't have to be your father. And if I woke up every morning attempting to be my dad, I would fail miserably because the shoes are just too large to try to fill. But certainly I believe I can add on to what my parents did, and that's the way that I look at it. I'm very comfortable with who I am, not trying to be. I'm going to always be the best Martin Luther King III that I can be, putting and extending the portion third, because as I said, if I attempted to be Martin Luther King Jr., I would fail miserably.
You have a great love and respect for your mother, clearly. What do you see as her legacy in the civil rights movement and human rights?
She created an organization back in a time when our nation was sort of chauvinistic. She sustained that organization and created a memorialized his work. So in a real sense, what she did was continued what my dad had started, but today we have a holiday named in his honor, and I don't want to say she directly is responsible, but certainly she was very much involved.
Let's turn to Senator Obama. There is, you know, regardless of whether or not you even want to vote for him, he has in some ways already transformed the racial landscape in America. Do you see that as, you know, part of the dream?
Well, I certainly see it as a part of the fulfillment of a portion of my dad's dream. You know, until we address the issue around housing and health care, issues of housing, health care, jobs, justice, we look at a criminal system in America where people of color comprise 80-90% of that system. And so it's clear to me that the system is not operating appropriately for people of color. And so we've got a whole myriad of issues to address before we can say that we've achieved the full dream that Martin Luther King Jr. envisioned for our nation. But certainly Senator Obama and his ascension, and if he's elected, and I believe that he certainly can be elected, I certainly think there's a great opportunity that he will be elected. That will be a major, major victory. But it does not mean that we will have resolved all the issues around race in America. But I do believe that in a very short period of time, probably, I don't even want to state an actual date, but in a very short period of time, race, I hope, can be behind us as a nation.
Well, Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Martin Luther King III is the founder of Realizing the Dream, which deals with sustainable initiatives in economic development, nonviolence, conflict resolution, and targeted leadership development for youth. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. A new report by the Children's Defense Fund found that gun-related deaths for children and teens increased for the first time since 1994. More than 3,000 children were killed by guns in 2005 alone. All this month, we're looking at what kids face today, including the dangers of firearms. In a few minutes, we're going to hear from the mayor of Trenton, New Jersey, on what he's trying to do to stop youth-related gun violence. But first, we've got Natasha Blaine. She's a lead strategic advisor for the Children's Defense Fund, which came out with a new study. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So talk a little bit about the study and what's really happening with kids and gun violence.
Well, as you note, our new study came out today. And since we found that in 2005, that there are over 3,000 children and teens who were killed by gun violence. And this is completely tragic. This doesn't have to be the case. Every 3 hours, a child or teen is killed by gun violence. That's 8 a day, the equivalent of a Virginia Tech shooting every 4 days.
What are we talking about here in terms of the scenarios? Because there can be, you know, children who shoot themselves accidentally. There's mm-hmm. gang violence. There's all sorts of things. What are we talking about in terms of breaking those numbers down?
We're talking about homicides. We're talking about suicides. We're talking about accidental deaths.
What's the preponderance?
Well, it looks like most of them are homicides, and a lot of them are suicides as well. They had over 822 children committed suicide in 2005. It's completely senseless.
So what would you recommend in terms of dealing with these different kinds of gun violence, all of which are fatal?
Well, we need to remove our guns from our homes. First and foremost, let's start at home. We know that a gun in the house will increase the likelihood of a homicide or a suicide happening. We need to remove them out the house. Today, we had a 4-year-old girl out of South Carolina. She's shopping with her grandmother. She removed her grandmother's handgun from her purse and accidentally shot herself in the middle of a supermarket.
Yeah, that's a very tragic case. Of course, though, when you talk about taking guns out of people's homes, that's one of the biggest hot button political issues. How do you talk to people who say, well, yeah, I'm going to keep my kids safe, but I'm keeping my gun?
The problem is that this is a 4-year-old child today, and she was able to find the gun. It didn't take her very long in order to do it and to fire it and to harm herself. And tragic as it is, this happens again so often. Her case, unfortunately, is not atypical.
What about the homicides? You know, sometimes teens shooting other teens, sometimes adults, what can you do or suggest to municipalities that are really trying to deal with this?
Well, we need common sense gun safety legislation. We do. About 40% of all firearms in the U.S. are purchased without a background check. 40%. So we need to close the gun show loophole, and we need to require these background checks for all guns, for those who are licensed and those who are also unlicensed to sell guns as well.
Your study also says that black males are almost 5 times as likely as white males to be killed by a firearm before the 30th birthday. Why do you think that is?
That's a very good question. I mean, there are many, many factors which go into that. We could also talk about the number of whites who also commit suicide. They are like 9 times as likely as their black peers to commit suicide as well. So we really need to curb our romance with guns and violence, quite frankly. If you turn on the TV, if you listen to music on the radio, you turn on the internet. It's very pervasive in our culture, and we need to confront this head on.
Finally and quickly, what do you think, what besides gun control could really help this issue? Things that, like education.
Yes, and we also need to stress nonviolent values and conflict resolution as well. We need to educate people. You know, CDF has been analyzing gun data since the early 1990s. And, you know, we're educating other people about this because we find it very curious that this is the first rise that we have seen in child and teen death with regards to firearms since 1994. Now, coincidentally, in 1994, that is when Congress passed the assault weapons ban. And it expired. Congress allowed it to expire in 2004. Well, here we have in 2005 data, the first data available after the ban was allowed to expire, and we see an increase of 181 children and teens who died.
Well, Natasha, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Natasha Blaine is a lead strategic advisor for the Children's Defense Fund. Now we're going to turn to the local issues around youth gun violence. Trenton, New Jersey has a high murder rate, a gang problem, economic challenges. Its mayor, Douglas Palmer, is also a member of Mayors Against Illegal Guns Coalition. Mayor Palmer and I spoke about how tough it is to keep kids safe from gun violence. Mayor Palmer, thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be on NPR.
Tell me a little bit about what Trenton is dealing with in terms of gun violence.
Well, certainly we've seen gun violence escalate in Trenton like it has throughout American cities because of the easy accessibility of illegal guns that are in the hands of criminals. In Trenton, we are actually like 3 minutes away from Pennsylvania. And while New Jersey has some of the toughest gun laws, Pennsylvania has some of the, and this is just my opinion, some of the most lenient gun laws. And as a result of it, over 50% of the guns that are seized in Trenton, illegal guns that are seized in Trenton, you know, come from Pennsylvania. We see as a result of increased gang activity, and that's tied with drugs, that violence has increased too. And so we know how critically it is important that we really address the issue of illegal guns coming into our cities.
Now, we're talking specifically all this month about kids. What do we need to know about how gun violence affects kids, either minors who may be actually using guns or people caught in the crossfire or victims?
Well, we need to understand that this is historic levels of the amount of young people and children that have died. I mean, since 1979, gun violence has killed over 104,000 children and teens in America, and that this goes in every area. I mean, 60% of them were white and 37% were African Americans, and, you know, this is a national epidemic.
What about kids who carry weapons to protect themselves against other kids? Kids who may feel, you know what, I really don't have a choice.
Well, you know, that just goes to a bigger problem of how these young people get guns anyway. I mean, it's a problem when certainly young people are getting guns illegally because it would be illegal for them to have guns. So first of all, you have to stop them getting guns illegally, but also deal with the problem of bullying and looking at through the schools, which I know a lot of this happens, bullying and making sure that you can have a zero tolerance policy so that kids can feel safe to even go to school, as well as finding out the reasons why they're not in school. And if it's because of bullying or if because they feel they need protection, then I think you have to deal with, first of all, making sure that you can have conflict resolution, but you have to be able to say that having a gun or carrying a gun certainly is not the answer.
What specifically have you tried as a mayor with certain powers and responsibilities that other people don't? What have you tried as a strategy that you thought would work but didn't?
Well, you know, certainly continuing, and it's very difficult, especially when you see every day, whether it's in the newspapers, TV, or video games, you know, the glamorization of violence, you know, how our movies and television shows and even music on the internet glamorize this. And so it's always tough when you have especially young people that look at movies and TV, they get caught up in it, is to try to have them stop. But it's important that we continue to do that. And what I'm continuing to do is really raise awareness of child and teen gun deaths and injuries so that we can actually put a face and a name to a statistic.
What do you think is the success of after-school programs or lack thereof in Trenton? What about issues that come up like curfews? Please be as specific as you can about a program or an approach that you think has made a difference.
The most dangerous time in a young person's life is between the hours of 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. This is when you have the schools are closed. And so that's when we see a lot of the problems happening with young people. That's why it's critically important that mayors are doing all across the country, opening up schools and after-school programs so that there can be a caring adult that's involved in these young people's lives. That works better than curfews, and that's what we need to continue to do, to continue to provide more after-school programs and having positive things for young people to do to keep them out of trouble.
Mayor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Douglas Palmer is the mayor of Trenton, New Jersey, and a member of Mayors Against Illegal Guns Coalition. Now we move on to our Africa update. Zimbabwean opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai for now says no to forming a unity government instead of having a runoff in the country's presidential election. Plus, in Somalia, a truce between insurgents and the government could be in jeopardy. Plus, we've got a look at how Africans are reacting to Barack Obama's run for the White House. For more, we've got Amira Wood. She is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hey, Amira.
Hey, Farai. Great to be with you.
Always. So let's talk about Zimbabwe. Morgan Tsvangirai leads the opposition party, the Movement for Democratic Change. Some people think he already won the presidency, but at the very least, there will be room for a runoff. But there's been a long delay in setting up this runoff against President Robert Mugabe and his party. Now, in a press conference today, Tsvangirai dispelled rumors that he and Mugabe's party are discussing a unity government. Do you think that that's even on the table, even if it's kind of below the table?
Well, I think Morgan Tsvangirai has said it best. He thinks the Movement for Democratic Change is convinced that they actually won outright the March presidential elections. And clearly, the Zimbabwe Election Commission did not agree. They had set up this runoff for June 27th. And Morgan Tsvangirai is saying, in spite of the intimidation, in spite of a climate of impunity, that he is going forward, that the Movement for Democratic Change will continue with this process. And so, yes, there is this commitment to go forward with a runoff, in spite of the fact that, you know, thousands of people around the country are reported to have been intimidated, harassed, and the numbers of people killed are just escalating daily. I mean, today, Morgan Tsvangirai put the number at, I guess, 60. But I think that number has been escalating. Clearly, there is high degree of intimidation politically and violence going on throughout Zimbabwe.
Tsvangirai also said Zimbabwe is being run by a, quote, military junta. And that's a term you sometimes hear when it comes to Myanmar, also known as Burma. Generally not a very friendly term. What do you think? Is that accurate?
Completely accurate. When you see what's going on, there's intimidation, both of the police and of the army and of these former war veterans here of Zimbabwe. So you have people, particularly supporters of Movement for Democratic Change and other opposition groups. You have labor leaders. You have human rights activists. You have clergy in many instances that are being targeted, you know, and there's this saying going on that, you know, bullets are being made available, one for each person who's a supporter of the opposition. This is clearly a climate of intimidation that is very much like a military junta would do.
Do we know anything about President Mugabe? That is, do we know who he's keeping counsel with? Do we know anything about from his past behavior, what his next move might be?
Well, that's so difficult to say, Farai. Clearly, the key thing for Mugabe seems to be maintaining his grip on power. It's 28 years, and he wants to extend that even further. What has been discussed is, you know, an exit strategy for Mugabe. What would be needed? Would there be some kind of an agreement that he wouldn't be brought up on human rights violations with an international criminal court or other such international venue? You know, so could there be an agreement or a deal made along those lines that would give him an exit strategy? There have been discussions, both quietly and publicly, about those types of possibilities. But it is so difficult to say. I think really the key thing that's been made clear here by Mugabe and ZANU-PF is their commitment to maintain their tight grip on power.
Let's take a quick look at two other issues. First is Somalia. There was a bloody battle in Mogadishu, and the government and some anti-government factions agreed to a 90-day truce. But now one of the leaders of a rebel Islamic group is rejecting a UN-sponsored peace deal. Give us a little sense of what's going on.
Well, we have to remember Somalia has been in a difficult position for the last 17 years. There have been, I think, about 14 peace deals being made over that time period. But what has happened in the last year and a half really is a systematic campaign where U.S. airstrikes and Ethiopian ground forces have essentially tried to enforce democracy in Somalia. And you have many within Somalia said, no, you cannot. Just as you cannot impose democracy with bombs in Iraq, you cannot impose democracy with bombs and an Ethiopian occupation of Somalia now. So I think there is tremendous resistance to the so-called peace efforts that have been made that are really interpreted by Somalis as occupation and have been rejected. So what has happened is there's been pressure, particularly from moderate forces within Somalia, to try to see, can there be a Somali-grown, a homegrown resolution to this crisis, a resolution that will maintain the dignity and also the political sovereignty of Somalis so that they choose their future, they choose their leaders, not the U.S. in particular or other outside forces, but Somalis themselves choosing their leaders and holding those leaders accountable. So there have been numerous attempts over the past few months. This one is a U.N. brokered effort. It doesn't seem as if it will. It is very likely to hold because one of the key factions, the Union of Islamic Courts, which held power for just a 6-month period, but maintained power, unity, and respect from many Somalis, they in their senior leadership have not endorsed this agreement. I think many other Somalis are saying, well, an agreement that has a clear exit strategy for the Ethiopians. This agreement has a 120-day time period after which the Ethiopian troops must leave. And and Somalis are thinking that that's a step in the right direction, but it will be still to be seen if there will be broader support and if this agreement will continue to hold.
All right, Amira, we were going to try to squeeze in Barack Obama, but I'm sure he's got plenty of time on the clock. Thanks a lot.
Hopefully long after November.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, and she joined us from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C.